We'll give our colleagues a couple minutes.
Okay, we'll be starting in about 2 to 3 minutes, I think.
So if the respective presenters are here, we have one. The rest of you, if you could form an orderly line and proceed to the front, that would be appreciated. And while folks are getting organized, I just wanted to mention that somebody at the CCNSO cocktail party forgot their swag bag, and it has your important personal notes in it, which I promise I didn't read, but there is, because yeah, the handwriting wasn't clear enough. Anyway, we do have it. And I think we have almost a full house, so good morning, everybody. Welcome to day 2 of the CCNSO meetings. We have, as usual, a jam-packed agenda, and the first session on security is going to be chaired by Nigel.
Yeah, good morning. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Nigel Roberts from .gg, almost a CCNSO councillor. Lewis, do you want to join us up at the front? Then I think that just leaves with Andre. And since I think he's down at the last, there's no desperate rush. Well, this topic is on security, and without more ado, Mr. Security is right at the extreme end, but I think I can see him. Patrick, would you like to start?
Sure, thank you very much. I've been asked to give a brief update on some of the latest advisories that we have released from ESSEC. So one thing that is important to remember when I go through this report is our charter. The charter of ESSEC is to advise the ICANN community and board on matters relating to the security and integrity of the Internet's naming and address allocation systems. Some people think we only work with DNS. So it has to do with anything related to security and integrity. So the reports that we have written lately are, of course, focused on DNS security, for example, 57, 59, 62, 63, and 64. But we are also dealing with various abuse issues, and that is one of the reports I will mention, number 65, on denial of service attacks, which unfortunately we see a quite large increase, not only using the DNS, but any kind of UDP-based protocol. We're still looking at internationalized domain names and related issues, including trademark clearinghouse, for those of you interested in that. And then, of course, who is? Unfortunately, there is a parallel session at the moment, and that's why my vice chair, Jim Galvin, is not here. And probably that's why some people that should be in this room is not here either, because internationalized registration data is an important topic for you. So there are two reports that we published lately. Let's take number 64 first. This is an advisory on DNS search list processing. In SAC 64, ESSEC examines, first of all, we examined how current operating systems and applications process search lists. We are looking at security and stability implications with some search list behaviors, and we also proposed a straw man to improve the search list processing. So first of all, what is search list processing? That is a feature that allows a user to enter partial domain name in an application, and the operating system will expand the name through entries in the search list. So for example, if you have a search list which is somedomain1.com, somedomain2.com, and the user just types system in the browser will look up system.somedomain1.com, system.somedomain2.com, and system in some order, not in a specific order, and that's one of the implications here. So types in one domain name, looks up three. So we had a look at this, and we see that there are great varieties in how operating systems handle these issues. Everything from not apply search lists at all to, which you see at the top, which is a mechanism we call never, to what you see at the end, that the browser application don't only apply search lists, they also, for example, add www before the domain name, which we think is a behavior that is not very good at all. But for some weird reason, applications like browsers are adding www in front of domain names. That's not good. The second thing we are looking at when we now know that there are these various behaviors, we look at the implications. And we have seen, we have been looking more carefully both at query leakage and also various privacy issues. Not only that that the DNS query itself might carry privacy information, but also we have been looking at what happens when the application actually try to connect to whatever data it got in the response to the IP address it got in response. And we see that there are many protocols which actually happily deliver email, cookies, and all different kind of things to potentially the wrong host. So it could be intentional. It could be the objective to register certain domain names to be able to create honeypots that collect this privacy information. Specifically, we have been looking also at applications that move between different environments, for example, laptops and phones that move between home, office, and a conference like this. And we have been looking at the different behavior and the different configuration that might that we recommend later for enterprises. If we look at queries to the root zone, we have been studying this for a couple of years, as you know, and we see that the number of queries for specifically the two top-level domains, home and corp, are extremely high and much higher than all the others. We also see that the number of queries for .home has increased dramatically and for .corp just a little bit. If we look at this with a logarithmic y-axis, you see that there are some others that also increase quite quickly, for example, ICE and a few others. Regarding the actual more generic namespace collision issues, there is, as you might know, the JAS Advisors report out for public comment, and I urge all of you to have a look at that one and comment on it. If we look at what is actually happening when someone types in, for example, www.corp, or uses www.corp, and you do have search list processing, this is one of the algorithms that is in use. The resolver issues the laptop or the user, the client side is issuing a query for www.corp, as you see on line number one. In line number two, you see that what's happening is that it gets back an NX domain, which means that the domain name www.corp does not exist. Then you have the search list added corp.example.com, so you have a query for www.corp.corp.example.com. NX domain, and then it adds chicago.example.com, for example, and it gets back that NX domain for that as well. Then at the end, it adds example.com, and you have a lookup for www.corp.example.com, and you get back an IP address. This is a normal search list processing that you see in quite a large number of operating systems and whatnot. Now, as you might understand, if you look at the first line, you have a query for www.corp. So this search list processing works only as long as you get NX domain responses for all of those queries except the last one. If .corp is allocated as a TLD and someone registers the domain name www, then the first query will actually return an IP address. And that is what creates the whole problem. So we have a strawman proposal includes, first of all, that there should not be any automatically generated search list. They should be explicitly configured. And this includes DHCP servers that should have explicitly configured search lists. If search lists should be used at all, of course, the best thing is, of course, to not use search lists. Secondly, that unqualified single-label domain names should never be queried directly. And this fits into the previous proposal that we had from ESSAC that having address records at the apex of TLDs is something that we strongly not recommend. There are some TLDs, specifically ccTLDs, which actually do have A records at the zone apex, and that is absolutely not a good thing. So we here recommend that clients stop to query for those. Instead, if you have a single label, in that case, search list processing should be applied. And the single label should never be queried. Alternatively, if there is a multi-labeled domain name, search list processing should not take place. And by having this trauma proposal, you know directly whether, when you have something that looks like a domain name, whether search list processing should take place or not. This is a big change from what's happening today. So in this report, we recommend that that RFCs are strengthened and updated that specifically talk about this trauma proposal and take that into account and try to come up with a well-defined well-defined algorithm for search list processing, and also once again point out that the work that ICANN is currently ongoing regarding namespace collision, that it's really important that program is continuing. Let me then mention very quickly, because we are sort of running out of time, SAC 65 on denial of service attacks. This report explicitly is about how DNS infrastructure is in use, but as many people, including many people in this room, know, at the moment we have similar attacks using NTP. So this is sort of a generic problem for all protocols that don't use a three-way handshake, which implies that the protocol itself validate that there is a bidirectional path between the client and server. This is when you have these kind of this problem. The underlying problem with these attacks is that at the ingress of ISP's network, specifically close to the edge, there is no source address validation. This is something that has been recommended in the IETF, and also is the ESSAC already in report number 4 told and recommended strongly the community should start to use source address validation. That is not implemented yet, and we really need to work together to resolve that. We talk about denial of service attacks, which today are more than 300 gigabits per second to name servers, NTP servers and such. So if you run DNS servers, you need to be able to handle 300 gigabits per second of traffic. This is an image that shows you an Adobe logo. This is really interesting because what we're trying to display here is a PDF document created by Adobe with a graph showing the flow of data. When you have a denial of service attack, you have to look at the document that hopefully is passed around to all of you. So what we are doing is that we are once again pointing out the various weaknesses and errors and problems we have in the currently deployed network that we need to do something about. For example, we do need better cooperation between operators of internet infrastructure and manufacturers to be able to take specific actions. There is, for example, recommendations that network operators must take immediate steps to prevent network address spoofing. This is so incredibly important. So even though I don't like regulation, I start to be close to actually start talk to regulators and tell them that they actually need to do something about this. This is the number one largest problem. Second largest problem is that we have recursive DNS of recursive servers here and there on the internet that still allow queries coming from anywhere on the planet. And this is also not a good thing because it gives the ability to get reflection attacks. And specifically, it's pretty bad that we find these recursive DNS servers in everything in CPEs, in home routers that manufacturers are selling, and they're default configured to be able to respond to queries from the global internet. The worst case I've seen was one mobile operator that bought from a vendor modems for 3G. And they shipped 150,000 of these before they discovered that it was a recursive server in it. The modem was not field upgradable. The users, the buyers of the modems have to go to a shop or themselves reflash the modem. And of course users don't do that. So we have 150,000 modems just in one ISP, and they don't know what to do about it because they don't know how to turn. They could turn them off, but of course that would make their customers unhappy. So vendors must be better when they are shipping things with default configuration. And then you have some other recommendations that we can skip. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. That was very interesting and, dare I say it, entertaining. I've always found it very strange that certain browsers put things like .com at the end and give priority to a particular TLD and others. I don't see anybody at the microphone yet. I'm sure there are questions, and I'd like to encourage everybody to use the microphone in the middle of the room. So if there's anybody questions for Patrick, can you wave your hand, please, and come up to the microphone?
I am really happy that people understood everything I said and will immediately take actions together with me to make sure that all the problems are resolved. See you on Tuesday.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Well, next on the agenda, we have something very interesting, which is we all need to know who to contact. So it's Christian and Lewis.
Okay, while the slides are being loaded, my name is Christian Hesselman. I'm with .NL. This is Luis Espinoza, chair of the Contact Repository Implementation Working Group. So anyways, I'll be talking about a survey that we conducted back in December and the potential next steps based on that survey. Here we go. So survey results and proposed way forward. That's the title of the presentation. Can I somehow switch slides? Or? Oh, it's over there. Okay. I thought there was a remote control. If you can do it, yeah, please.
Is the remote here?
Is this the one?
Yeah. See if this works. Otherwise, you
no, can't. No. Can you do it, Liz? Okay. So first of all, some background about on the history of the working group. So the goal of the working group was to look into the implementation of a ccTLD contact repository. So that's basically a service or a system, if you will, that enables ccTLD operators to contact each other in case of serious or major incidents regarding the availability availability and integrity of the DNS or the registration systems that are being managed by the various ccTLDs. So this included work on the technical requirements, but also on funding models and governance models. The working group was basically bound by a couple of requirements, which is the non-binding relationship between ccTLDs and other entities, diversity, policies and practices guiding ccTLDs, and a couple of technical requirements such as 24/7 availability. And the working group was basically set up after the incident response working group finished, which was, I think, back in 2011. So we've been going on for quite some time. Next slide, please. Well, the layout is a bit off, so please try to ignore that. So the survey that we conducted back in December of 2013, the motivation for doing it is that during the work, we discovered that we often had difficulties conveying the added value of the service because we didn't have any real-world use cases or real-world scenarios. And also,
We discovered that the financial constraints that were put in place somewhat complicated the development and the operation of the service, and as a result, also the work that we conducted in the working group. And we also felt that the potential added value of the service depended on, let's say, the number of subscribers that would participate in the system. So it would only work if a large number of CCTLDs would participate. And our final motivation for conducting the survey was that the landscape, the TLD landscape, had significantly changed since the working group was established back in 2011 somewhere. So we have registries as now as high value targets. And, of course, we also have the new GTLDs. So we felt that it was necessary to check with the community how they perceived the added value of the service and how they felt about things like the costs associated with it. So the audience that we targeted were people responsible for security and stability at their CCTLD. And if you could go to the next slide, please. And these are basically the results. So we received a total of 53 responses, which is pretty good for a CCNSO survey. 26 of the respondents actually filled out the questionnaire completely. So the top table is the one with the scores for all the respondents, and the bottom table is the one with the respondents that filled out the questionnaire completely, so that filled out all questions. And the most important questions are... Could you hit the... The most important questions are the third and the fourth one. So how do you feel about the added value of the contact repository, and are you willing to pay for the? Would you be willing to pay for the service in terms in the form of a subscription fee? And in both cases, it turned out that people perceive the added value of the service is pretty high, but there was, let's say, limited willingness to actually pay for their service. So that's also the main result of the survey. Could you go to the next slide, please? Yeah, so a global CCTLD contact repository is still being considered as valuable for the community, the CCTLD community. So we're seeing a strong perceived added value. People are actually also willing to participate in drafting realistic use cases that would underpin the added value of the service. And we also focus on the right types of incidents. That's one of the questions that we also asked during the survey. But the tension is that, the problematic thing is that there's a tension with the willingness to pay for the service. Next slide, please. So we thought about that for a while, and then we came up with the following recommendation, which is to take an iterative approach and start out very simple with a secure mailing list, so at virtually no cost, and then iteratively expand the system based on the experiences that people would have with the secure mailing list. And that would, for instance, allow for more for trust building within a community. It would also allow for aligning the perceived added value with the cost of the service. And we also recommend that to consider alternatives such as a more regional approach, maybe through center or through LAC TLD. Next slide, please. So if we would, let's say, opt for a secure mailing list, then this is what it could look like. So this is just an example. So you could have a mailman service hosted by a neutral party such as ISAC or ICANN. You could, for each CCTLD, you could have the people responsible for security and stability of that CCTLD on the mailing list, and it could, for instance, be the CEO of the CCTLD who decides who gets on the mailing list. And so basically that would then give you a very rudimentary contact repository, basically the list of subscribers, plus a communications channel, which would be email. And then you would need a second or a new working group to actually set up and manage the list. Since this is pretty simple, we kind of reckon that this would be doable before the London ICANN meeting. Next slide, please. So if you look at the time, not sure if you guys can read it all the way in the back, but what it says here is that the blue part over there and the, on the top left is the activity of the current working group. We would basically write our proposal and our recommendation and send it to the council. And then a new working group, which is the bits in green, would set up the secure mailing list, which is the which would then run roughly from June up until, well, a couple months. And then in the second half of this year, so maybe after the meeting in Los Angeles, we could refine the use cases, refine the funding model, and refine the governance model based on the experience that we got through the secure mailing list. So that's the iterative approach. Next slide, please. Okay, so proposed short-term actions. First one is to basically write our final report and send it to the council, including our recommendations. That's something we plan to do at the end of this month, at the end of April, sorry. And then close the CRI working group and start a new working group to implement the recommendations. Next slide, please. And this slide basically is to ask you for your gut feeling right now. What do you think of this approach? What would be the room temperature? Maybe you could use your red, green, and orange cards to flag what you think. Or not.
Thank you. Christian Lewis?
Yes. I'm the chair of this working group, and I want to tell you something a little bit about this roadmap of this working group. This working group has been here for a long time. And in some point, to be honest with you, we get stuck in some kind of vicious cycle about what could be the ideal content repository and have some offerer to provide the cost of that. And we never get an offerer to provide the real cost of to maintain this kind of content repository, then we get stuck in some kind of cycle. This solution about the secure mailing list comes here to break a little bit this vicious cycle and provide some output. But I think it's important in some point in the future take again the full contact repository with all the features it was expecting from the beginning. But then this will be a very good solution, I think. Christian came with this solution to the working group, and I see it's very practical. And I love the thing practical, but I don't know what happened with us in the past. But, well, it is important to have your big feedback in this if somebody wants to say something. Thank you.
Thank you to both of them. Questions? Questions?
Maybe a show of cards will help.
I'm sorry?
Maybe we can ask the people to raise the orange, the red and green cards.
Okay. You all have your your colored cards. I'd like to see who's in favor of this. I don't see anything except a green card there. That's good.
Thank you.
So now I want some questions. No, I mean, I want some questions. Seriously, are we all still asleep from last night? Well, thank you again to both of you then. So next, Peter, can you go to the microphone, please?
Thank you for the update. You mentioned the funding model could be subscription fee model. Do you have any indication in what band we're talking?
I don't have that information, but perhaps you do. About the cost, if we
when you were discussing the funding model, you were suggesting a subscription fee. Do you have any indication of the size of that fee? Is that just to estimate whether it will be feasible for smaller ccTLDs or not?
Yes, the reference we had in the past was trusted introducers, that is a contact emergency operator in Europe, I think. And the cost is something around $1,000 per year per cc, is something like that. That maybe for a well-organized cc, it's a common sense, but For the most of the small CCTLDs or the CCTLDs that don't have enough conscience about the importance of this content repository, maybe it will not be feasible to pay that amount of money. Then my personal opinion about that cost is too high, because in fact this content repository is a kind of system based on some address book, and the other part of the service is a contact center like services. That part of the content repository is very expensive, because you need people to start proof all the media contacts, mediums, phone. Not only electronic mediums, you know, that other kind of medium like phone or fax or that kind of things is very expensive to have people doing calling. That's more like.
Thank you, Lewis. Bart, did you want to say something? You were up at the microphone. Bart, you were up at the microphone. Did you want to say something? Okay, fine. Okay, well, thank you very much indeed. Right, next we have... next we have Ryan. I think he's going to talk about digital identity and something. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Right, good morning. My name is Ryan. I'm from .sg. This morning, I'm going to share with you a very pretty interesting scheme that we launched recently. It's called the Verify ID at SG. Basically, it's trying to mitigate identity thefts in .sg registrations. So, wait a second. Full screen. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm not good with the Mac. How do I I'm sorry, it's a bit weird, but now I'll just continue. So the scope of my presentation is first I'm going to tell you what problem we are facing and how we went about doing the solutioning, and then what was our plan, and eventually when we launched, what were the issues that we faced. So the problem is that because we allow real-time and online registration of names, you'll find that it's not very difficult to fake identity or perform identity theft. And, well, by itself, it's not a big issue, but the issue is that identity theft is often a precursor to other forms of abuses like malicious domain, Trojan horses, and so on and so forth. And what is even worse is that even if we manage to catch the guy who performed that bad act, he can get away scot-free, because we don't know who the guy is. So of course you can mitigate such problems. How do you do that? You can investigate suspicious cases. You look at the domain registrations that comes in every day, pick up suspicious cases and follow up on them, or you could add or complaints. How serious is the situation in .sg? Those we come to know of them is only a couple of cases. But the main worry is those that we do not know. To be honest, we don't know how many of our domain names are registered to nobody. So essentially, we look at it that this is actually a time bomb for us. Can you imagine somebody coming up to us and says, what do you mean you do not know who registered their domain name? So, I mean, this is something I think happened in China a couple of years ago, and we do not want that to happen in our country. So what do we do? We have a couple of solutions. The best way, we think, is to for the person to apply in person with a stack of documentary proofs. Now, with company certs, individual identity card numbers, passport, letters, and so on and so forth. But it's not going to work for us. We know that the business is going to suffer. And then we thought of other ways. But whatever solution we come up with, it has to meet three criteria. Number one, we need to have positive identification of the registrant. We need to preserve the online and real-time nature of the registration, and yet the verification process needs to be very fast and very simple. So we thought, Singapore has something called the SingPass system. It stands for Singapore Personal Access. Well, pretty much anybody in Singapore who lives or work here is issued a SingPass, and this is done by the Singapore government after they know who you are. So what it is actually a set of username, which is your IC number, much like a social security number, and the government issue a set of password. And it's not a white elephant. This SingPass system is in use for many e-services current day. For example, you buy a house, buy a car, apply for a credit card, file your income tax, and so on and so forth. So we thought, maybe there's a way to marry SingPass with domain name registrations. And it works very well because currently all .sg registrations already require a Singapore local admin contact. So we said, oh, maybe we could further require the admin contact to have a SingPass ID. And then this admin contact could authenticate himself via SingPass, and then he can vouch for the identity of the registrant. So we put a human factor back into the verification process, and we hope that it will mitigate the identity theft cases, because the admin contact in this case could be implicated if he helps a crook buy a domain name. So how it works is that admin contact has got 21 days to perform the verification. Otherwise, we will suspend the domain name, meaning the name will cease to resolve on the internet. And we want to be very careful, so we send out very naggy email reminders on a daily basis to everybody, admin contact, registrant, the registrar. And this is what you will see on the who is if you are out immediately after registration but before verification. There's a new domain status known as the verified ID at SG-pending. And so if the admin contact reacts to our email, he logs on to our verified ID portal, clicks on this button here to log on into SingPass, enters his SingPass ID password, click submit. And he goes to this particular page where the domain name is listed with all the details of all the registration details. Tick on the checkbox and click verify identity button, and that's it. This is a very fast 2-step, 5-minute process. And back success emails will be sent to the admin contact and the registrant, and the whois you will see the status turns to verify ID at SG-OK. So after many years of preparation, we finally launched a 6-month trial in last year in May, and then we prayed because we actually prepared for the domain registrations to drop because some people may think that this is too much trouble, I'd rather buy a .com instead. And interestingly, there were very few negative feedback. We have about 3 such feedback over, say, 10,000 domain names. And there was no drop in the volume. In fact, the volume rose. And we found that the admin contact, 75% of them actually could verify their domain names within 24 hours. They were very cooperative. And by the 21 days, 99% of them would have verified. And what we particularly like is that the quality of the registration data actually improved. People actually bothered to call us and say, hey, my reseller put the wrong data into the system. How do I get about correcting those data? And there were no suspected cases of identity theft and fake identity cases during the 6-month trial. On the negative side, we have an increase in the email and phone queries, but that's pretty normal. And with that, we converted the scheme into a permanent scheme since November. So to summary, from before, we didn't know who was the person who registered the domain name. Now we have a real person who can vouch for the identity of the registrant. So with that, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ryan. Well, it's very interesting. I can see that it would be very effective in a country where you have an established SingPass-type system, and it's also the admin contact must be a person to that applies. And I'd be interested to know from other TLDs how that might apply to them. Have we got any questions? I'm sure we must have some. Oh, yeah, I can see one. Yeah, if you please make your way to the microphone.
Hi, Stefan Johnson, .se. What about corporations? When do you sign as an individual or for corporations as well?
Well, the admin contact needs to be a person. So he vouches that the registrant is the corporation.
So it's connected to an individual person when you sign for a company then, right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Stefan. Any more? Yeah, please come up to the microphone.
Hi, good day. Stanford Mings and Nick.vi. Can you go back to the post, to the slide where it shows you the information regarding the user? To verify? Okay.
Down or up? Sorry.
I'm sorry?
Should I go forward or backwards? This is the one?
To where they verify, where it's verified.
Where it's verified. Who is? This one.
Okay, so you're only showing the status information. You're not showing any information regarding the single pass or anything like that.
You mean the single pass ID within the admin contact details?
Okay, correct.
Is that right? Yeah, we correct. Don't.
You don't?
We don't. As a background to this, our WHOIS is one of a kind. We only show the name of the registrant, admin contact, and technical contact. And the only extra bit of information that we show is the technical contact's email address. So WHOIS is very, very clean. No other information is on the WHOIS.
Okay, so you have a relationship with the Singapore government to confirm that the SingPass is a legit number?
Not directly. The person who owns the SingPass would have... So if he authenticates with the SingPass, we know that he's the owner of the SingPass. So we don't have a direct link with the government in that sense. I'm not sure whether I answered the question correctly.
When you say you're verified, how do you verify? How do you know that, I don't just come off the plane and give you the number, give you a pass. How do you as the CCTLD?
Yes, so you have the pass and you have your own password. So if you go to this authentication portal to log in using your username and your password, I know that you own this username.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess I'm not understanding it. This username and password, is that something that's provided by the government, or is that, I'm assuming that's provided by the government?
Yes.
And how do you confirm that's the correct password?
I'll go back a couple of slides and I'll show it to you. So this window at the bottom, it is an authentication portal run by the SingPass, which is run by the government.
Oh.
Yeah, so I throw him to this portal to log in, and the portal gives me okay or not okay answer. And brings me back to, if it's okay, it brings me back to my portal.
Okay, I see it. Thanks. Okay, thank you.
So actually, it's a little bit like when you're paying by something by credit card and you have taken to verified by Visa or something like that, except it's run by the government and it tells you it's this person.
Yes, yeah, in a way. Yes.
You could say there's almost like two-step authentication? Two-step authentication?
This is a username and password, so your question is there another third factor? Yeah, you know. At the moment, no, but I think the guys are looking at another second factor authentication for this login.
Okay, thank you.
Any more questions, please? If not, thank you, Ryan. Okay, we have two more presentations in this theme. Is Barry Braley here from .nz? Please come up. Okay, when you're ready.
Good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to come here and speak today. I'm going to talk about an initiative I'm involved in called the New Zealand Internet Task Force, and I kind of subtitled it as a bottom-up approach to improving the cybersecurity posture of a country. So, quickly, the program. I'm going to introduce with a little bit of background about New Zealand and some of the scene setting of how the NZITF came into existence, the birth of a trust group, so to speak. I'll cover off .nz's role in that, and it has been quite significant. And then I'll touch on the way we work and some of the working groups and initiatives that we're working on currently for New Zealand. I'm happy to take questions during, if important, but otherwise questions and answers at the end. So I'm a security guy. I've done security for both the New Zealand and the UK government in different roles. I've also worked for a global engineering company as a security guy. I'm currently the manager of security policy for the .nz Domain Name Commission. And my other role, I suppose, is the vice chair of the New Zealand Internet Task Force. So to cover off, the NZITF is a non-profit with the lofty mission of improving the cybersecurity posture of New Zealand. It's a collaborative effort based on mutual trust. We try to get active participation out of our membership. We can only actually do stuff with people volunteering their time, effort, and goodwill towards achieving some of our outcomes. A little bit about New Zealand. I'm sure that everyone's familiar here. So New Zealand, otherwise known as Middle Earth, pretty famously known as Middle Earth, I suppose. So we're located quite far down in the southern hemisphere, kind of halfway between Australia and Antarctica, which explains the weather patterns that we experience as well. And I'd like to do my plug for the New Zealand Tourism Board here. New Zealand is an excellent place for many reasons. We're pretty good at sport. We're a good place to make movies. We also have some fantastic scenery, adrenaline sport capital of the world. We have lots of sheep, pretty famous for sheep. In fact, for our 4.4 million population of people, we have 32 million sheep, so seven each. And those are some pretty attractive ones, I thought, on the bottom left there. You can't be brilliant at everything. So in terms of cybersecurity and approach, and I'll be honest, I worked for both of the organizations that I'm talking about here. So the government's approach to cybersecurity has not been breathtaking or huge in its scale. So back in 2002, the government did establish the CCIP, which had some CERT-like functions, but it primarily focused on cybersecurity threats to critical infrastructure. So it didn't go as far as actually becoming a national CERT. And then to a great extent, despite some significant efforts by Internet NZ and .nz entities to try and get a national CERT off the ground, not a lot really happened in the top-down approach until about 2011, when they published a cybersecurity strategy, probably the last of the developed countries to actually publish it. But they published it. It's worth a read. It won't take you long. And then off the back of that, the CCIP was expanded slightly to become the National Cybersecurity Centre. I was also involved in that, I'll be honest. There is some decent resource there, but the scope is still quite narrow. So they're focused on services for government agencies, critical infrastructure, and a few large companies. So we're still missing that sort of national piece at this stage. And there's been a bit of legislative change, which I'm not going to cover in this, but that takes us up to 2012. And then if you think about the security landscape that the world was in at this time. So back in 2002, this was when we were really seeing all the blaster and worms were becoming extremely popular, and home users were really becoming super aware of what security meant. And then the rise of hacking, or at least notoriety of hacking, came out with the NASA attacks and the subsequent extradition case, etc. Then it saw the Estonia and Georgia attacks around the sort of 2006-2007. So this is like DDoS on a national scale, suggestions of government involvement. And then the large-scale cyber espionage network started to be talked about around the GhostNet stuff in 2007-2008. And then, of course, the sort of a significant point for New Zealand in the creation of this was the Conficker worm and the millions and millions of infections that saw. New Zealand was actually quite heavily affected by this. The Ministry of Health was offline for a number of days, several thousand dollars worth of cleanup action. And then several months later, in an unrelated incident, a district health board also suffered a significant Conficker outbreak. And Although not massive, both of those incidents did actually impact the delivery of patient care in the health system, which obviously should be alarm bells. But off the back of that, there still wasn't that impetus from a top down to actually address things or improve how stuff was doing. And then since then, we've seen the sort of almost ubiquitous problems with the likes of the Zeus and the SpyEye botnets that proliferate around the internet. And then, of course, Stuxnet in 2010. And that, obviously, there's been an interesting evolution of how security is viewed since then, but it's been a very busy sort of decade just to that point. So going back to around 2008, 2009, one of the people that's still involved in the Internet Task Force was invited to go to what was then called the Botnet Task Force and has since evolved into the Digital Crimes Consortium, the DCC event. And so Mike attended this. He works for Telecom and one of our larger telcos and ISPs. And he came back and he found this collaborative approach to security to be quite interesting. A few months later, the Cyberstorm 2 exercise was held in New Zealand. And again, there's some security professionals getting together, this collaboration, the discussing and sort of spitballing ideas that they started to get the idea that this could be something that would actually work as an approach to security. And then in the 2009 Config issue and the New Zealand efforts of the Config Working Group, that's where those kind of impromptu and operational relationships suddenly start to pay dividends. So in 2008, the Botnet Task Force in New Zealand was established. And then in 2009, we renamed it to the New Zealand Internet Task Force because the scope quickly got bigger than just the botnet issues that we were seeing. Around the 2009, we were starting to think about how we could expand the membership and the things that we were going to focus on, and this sort of the organic birth of the organization. So at this point, I thought it's quite useful to mention the involvement of .nz in all this. So the Domain Name Commission, New Zealand Registry Services, and Internet NZ were very engaged in the Config Working Group. And they were also, therefore, in at the ground level, so to speak, and engaged in the whole Botnet Task Force to New Zealand Internet Task Force. They even formalised their support early on in 2009. They were keen to give us administrative support whenever we needed it. They provided venues for meetings, et cetera, et cetera. And then once we got into formalisation, they've also been active participants as members. They employ me and allow me to spend some of my day job working on this, which is also a useful participation. And they still provide the financial administration and facilities for our banking, et cetera, as part of the support to the society. And we also use the NZITF to influence, as a group, how we deal with security matters internally. So if it's a bigger than group-like issue, we'll consider using NZITF consultation or getting feedback through the NZITF. So we've adopted it as an almost integral part to how we're going to do security as a group. So the early days, obviously it was a fairly small start. We were deliberately not very public in how we were going about it. In the first instance, it was kind of, well, I know two other guys that would be pretty good for this. We should get them involved as well. So that kind of shoulder tapping, slow growth to get enough people to actually start to achieve some positive outcomes. We were lucky enough, both myself and my predecessor at CCIP were able to spend a bit of our time. So although there were government employees involved, it wasn't a top-down initiative from the government, if you know what I mean. But quite often there would be other security-related events, and we try and coordinate a side meeting or a bit of a discussion on the growth of NZITF around that, certainly in 2009, 2010. We established a steering committee, and we moved forward, and then 2011, we formally incorporated as a society, which is a little bit unusual for some of the trust groups. Those of you in the room that are members of some of those mailing lists and trust groups will appreciate that a lot of them don't actually have a legal presence. But in order to achieve some of the things that we wanted, we needed to be able to have a bank account, amongst other things, actually have a flow of cash, and having an incorporation as a society made that a lot easier. We introduced a very easy membership fee structure. So individuals, $50 a year for membership gives us enough funding. And then we have a corporate funding structure where some corporates donate about $500 as their membership structure. And we also, in 2011, held our first kind of public fanfare, publicly advertised event, which is where we were lucky enough to get Bruce Schneier in Wellington. He was there for another event, actually. So we hired a theatre, and we got 400 people in to listen to Bruce Schneier. So the population of Wellington is about 400,000. So 400 people that with enough of an interest in IT and security to want to come and listen to Bruce Schneier talk for 40 minutes was pretty significant. We saw a hype in our membership as a result, because obviously our profile suddenly raised, and so that was useful in terms of getting the right people in to actually get some work done. We also, obviously with that comes a board, so the board's pretty well spread across the security community. We don't have board members who are from the exact same company. It's one of our requirements, so membership companies are there. So we've got a couple of the larger telcos and ISPs, a government department, independent consultants, myself, one of the banks, and PricewaterhouseCooper, all represented through the different members of the board. The reason the board are actually, I suppose, and comprise the majority of the working committee stuff as well, so a lot of the initiatives are driven directly from the board because of the way we operate. We do still operate with a trust group-like approach, so members are nominated and vouched on, and that we still find is useful because we want to have those frank and candid discussions, which in the security community, it's kind of, if people aren't prepared to exchange information, there's no real collaboration that you can achieve. So the only way that we've come up with so far to maintain that level of trust is to stick to this kind of nominating and vouching. So it's not an entirely open society, but it is an incorporated society nonetheless. We also adopted the traffic light protocol, which is pretty well known in the CERT community and security community. And that just gives us a classification system for how we can exchange information. It's pretty easily understandable, red obviously being somewhat sensitive, amber and green being easier. So we use that internally in communications and also at face-to-face meetings. We organize 2 to 3 face-to-face meetings a year and a 2-day conference where we try and get some international speakers in. And we also lay on a significant part of it is training and then working groups, which I'll touch on a little bit more now. So talking through some of the things we've been able to achieve in the last 4 years or so, we're really keen to provide technical training. One of the problems with being a rather remote country in the world is that there's not an easy and abundant supply of technical security training or trainers in New Zealand. And what technical training there is in New Zealand can also be quite cost prohibitive, we find, which doesn't help with the development of skill sets. So we've been lucky enough to secure a lot of support from various organisations. We invariably don't end up paying a lot of these guys for their time for actually providing the training. We might lay on accommodation. Occasionally, we cover travel. But we do rely on getting a lot of time from people for free. We organise them as and when we can secure someone who's of a suitable standard to talk. We've trained over the last... So some of these course topics that I'm showing here, we've delivered multiple times and in different cities. And I think in the last 4 years, we've probably trained in the region of about 300 people in these different things, and they're predominantly hands-on technical type training. And we deliver it for anywhere from $150 to $500 or $600 New Zealand for 2 days technical training, which is amazingly cheap for hands-on technical training. We've offered those to the broader security community or the public, I should say, if we have space, but most of the time we're full by the time we make the offering to membership. We've also supported various industry and community initiatives, and we continue to lend that support, including support back to things like NetHui and encouraging our membership to get involved in that New Zealand IGF-like process. And we've arranged a couple of graduate secondments as well. So we've got, as membership, we've got 2 or 3 of the higher education institutes are also members of the NZITF. And so we've had master's graduates who have done master's on things like botnet reverse engineering or HoneyNets. And we've placed them in industry on secondments, et cetera, which has helped actually transition them into successful jobs within New Zealand. And we've also, both through manpower and financially, supported research initiatives and survey-type activity as well. I'll touch on some of our ongoing work within New Zealand, just to give you an idea of some of the working groups or initiatives that we focus on. So we identified a couple of years ago that there was a shortfall in standards-based security professionals, and security testing is something that organisations can spend a lot of money on. We identified an organisation out of the UK that does that's called CREST, Council of Registered Ethical Security Testers. They're a pretty high standard, and this is mostly the pen testing, but they're also into the network forensics as well. We haven't formally established this into NZ. We've worked with Australia in the first instance. We've got a growing number of guys that have achieved CREST certification. At this time, we haven't built the buyer demand where they're prepared to pay extra for the security testing, but as neighbouring markets start to adopt it, we envisage that it will. CREST is one of those things where we've just incubated the idea. We've got it to a point that we, once the demand and conditions are right, we can probably just spin it off and establish it as an organisation in its own right, and NZITF can move on to focusing on its normal business. And we also identified that a lot of organisations in New Zealand would benefit from greater involvement in readiness training or cyber exercising. So we've got an ongoing initiative to focus on that. Thus far, we've focused on some communications checks and testing the readiness and procedures of some of our membership. We're now into sort of scenario discussions and deciding if we want to move this forward to actual exercise play. And the other one that's turned into a... So, I don't know if you're aware, in Australia a few years ago, they launched what's called the iCode, which is the Voluntary Security Code of Practice for ISPs. It was presented to NZITF by Internet NZ, actually, as something that perhaps we could look at and give some thought to, and it's, do we need the iCode in New Zealand? And the question, obviously, was, well, we don't really know what the problem is, and the iCode seems to be a solution to the problem. So we needed to understand a bit more about the problem before we went straight to this. So we went out and realized we needed to get the data sources that would help us make an informed decision about the size of the problem in New Zealand. So there's a lot of data sets from people like Shadow Server that are publicly available to organizations, providing you have a right or that they're at an ASN or something like that. They'll give you the data that's relevant to you. Through negotiation and agreement, they actually give us all of the Shadow Server data that's relevant to NZ. And we also have signed NDAs with some commercial entities. So obviously I can't actually tell you who they are, which would help. But yeah, so we signed these NDAs and we've received other data feeds on malicious websites, malicious domains, other botnet data feeds. Even this week at this event, someone's offered me another feed of data that could be useful, including malware samples that perhaps some of our universities might be interested in. So we've brought all that data in really with the intent in the first instance to measure the size of the problem. But then, of course, we're security practitioners, so we have to actually see things get fixed, and we get alarmed when we see bad things. So we've also, in the short term, we had to go out and identify the appropriate teams in New Zealand that we could on-push this data to and ensure that they would reach out to customers or ISPs and try and clean up some of those problems. So it's ended up in a slightly more operational place than perhaps we were originally intending, but now we're just starting to get the feedback from those recipients on what they think the main problems are. So we're already seeing that the iCode or a version of it might help, but it's not just in the ISP space that it would need to be targeted. So that's an ongoing piece of work that could well sit with us for quite some time. But the aggregation and dissemination of the data was an interesting activity in itself. And then on the vulnerability disclosure initiative, I thought I'd talk through the example. So this was last year. I've called him a researcher, but someone discovered what he felt was a significant flaw in the Ministry of Justice website. In my opinion, not necessarily quite the correct path. He actually reported this to the opposition party. So an MP from the opposition party was the person that he decided that he should highlight this problem to. So obviously, political opposition parties being what they were, they gave the government 24 hours notice before going to the media. There's a bit of media furore around it, and then the Justice Minister comes out and makes that comment, which obviously sends a shiver through a lot of security researchers that they're perceived as being hackers by the government in the same vein as burglars. So within the NZITF, we realised that this highlighted an issue that had been simmering for quite some time, probably. If you, at the time, we perceived that if you report a security vulnerability to a New Zealand website owner, you've got a 50-50 chance of being reported to the police. The other 50% of the time, you'll probably spend days, if not hours, if not days, trying to explain to them why it's a problem, and then they may or may not do something about it. So So whilst vulnerabilities are being observed and discovered in the course of people's normal work, the reality is that most security researchers are reluctant to even try and report them because of the pain and hassle that can invoke. So obviously this is well back into the NZITF's core business, I suppose. We realised we had to do better. The NCSC from Holland actually published an interesting set of guidelines which gave us a good working template for how a responsible disclosure proposal could work on a national level. So we drafted up a document that we felt would work for New Zealand, and we released that for public consultation towards the end of last year. We did a six-week public consultation on it. We also presented on it and did like forum-based consultation at the Open Web Application Security Project and KiwiCon, which is a hacker conference in New Zealand. That consultation and feedback's been taken back in, and the working group's now working on the final version, which we'll probably make public around the middle of the year. We'll probably get that signed off at the AGM to make sure that the membership is happy with it at that time. What we're trying to do with this one is just to improve the maturity and the approach to these vulnerabilities. And NZRS, New Zealand Registry Services, has actually got a really good example. If you're on their website, NZRS has already published their vulnerability reporting policy, and they also, on their website, publish the vulnerabilities that have been reported and they've mitigated, et cetera, which gives the recognition to the reporting party as well. That they've done the right thing. So what we would like is for a significant swathe of New Zealand websites and businesses to take that kind of approach as a good, mature example of how vulnerability disclosure should be handled from both sides. So that concludes my presentation on the New Zealand Internet Task Force. I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you very much. That was very, very interesting, actually. Come on, there must be some questions. Yeah, I see one. That's great. Maybe that's just the start of... if you come up to the microphone, that'd be great. And if you could give your affiliation as well, please.
Neil Elhimam from .id. I just have a question with regard to the scope of the CSIRS or the CERT of the New Zealand's. Does it only cover the .NZs or... .NZs or any other domain, top-level domain?
So the NCSC, CCIP type stuff, do you mean, or NZITF? So the NZITF, it's for New Zealanders, so anyone that's any entity in New Zealand could be a member. It's not related to .NZ as the CCTLD. And likewise with government initiatives as well, they're New Zealand and not related to the CCTLD.
Thank you.
Peter, I think. Yeah, thank you.
You mentioned that you're making use of data feeds on
yes.
security incidents. These are not just related, or these are not related to DNS as such. They are overall security incidents?
Yeah, it's the general feeds around botnet infection rates that are being geolocated to being in New Zealand. So it's not security stuff pulled from the DNS. And also malware distribution websites that are being identified through other sources, again, not DNS related. So it's a feed that we think will help explain the picture on the size of the problem, but also that invariably the feed hopefully will have something that we can push to someone else to try and get things cleaned up and improved so that we're keeping that hygiene and ongoing cleanliness of New Zealand internet space.
Okay. That's obviously on a specific national level. The Central Security Working Group is working on a security incident repository. And I'm wondering if there are ways in which we can tie those two together, or that there is at least some bridge between the two sets of information. But I'll ask the chair of the Security Working Group to get in contact with you.
Excellent. Yeah, definitely. Look forward to it.
Can we encourage any more questions? Any more comments? No, I think that's it. Thank you very much indeed. That was very interesting. Okay. We seem to be doing fine for time. So, Andre.
Good morning. So let me continue the saga which we started November of 2012. So it's been quite a lot of time since that, since we started an interesting experiment with leading Russian companies, which ended up in a very interesting results and a very effective mechanism fighting the malware and other kind of bad things in the internet with national domain names. Let me just remind you how this works. So we have a partners, which is a leading Russian companies, including Kaspersky, Yandex, Rostelecom, to name a few. So what we do, we have a data feeds and a database of the malware. So we get from the partner, we get the initial list of the bad domains, assign a hash number to this domain name, and combine requests from the registry the other domain names which belongs to this hash number, so without disclosing the actually registrant data, and send it back to the database, send it back to the initial domain sender, the partner, and get a final list of bad domains from the partner into the center database. So the other people and other companies who's, who has an access to this database, within a 24-hour cycle, are able to tag malicious domain names with a bad code and phishing. Actually, this initiative started to find an efficient way to fight the phishing, because from many points of view, this is a most hazardous thing in the internet. So currently we have this 24-hour cycle and to effectively block the bad domains. What then happens? For example, the search engine, the Yandex, which has more than 80% of the market in Russia, of the search market, they tag the bad URLs, bad domain names in their search engine, and so they're not displayed in the search result. Also, these domains are tagged in the Kaspersky database, which has more than 200 million installations all over the world. Also, some of the domains going back through the RuCert to other cert members, and also Rostelecom, the largest telecom provider, operator in Russia, also have a few tricks to certainly tag these domain names for their customer user base. Also, one of our partners, which is Group IB, it's like we call it that cyber police. That's guys who's actually collecting the evidence and write it up so it can be used in different legal forms against the bad guys in the internet. So what do we have now? It's we have 1.2 million domain names tagged in a database. And since the beginning of this year, we added about 21,000 domain names in the database, and including almost 9,000 malicious also. There is a categories here. Let me show you. It's something wrong with the screen. Yeah, like this. So added up 6,000 malware, about 1,000 of the phishing domain names, and about 2,000 spam domain names. The most common use of the domain names, of course, is a malware. It's different kind of bad codes and trojans and all the bad scripts on the sites. And this is very common. This is very common thing on the internet. So because it's really hard to find a legal ways or go after every malicious resource with a police, for example. This schema, which works with .ru, really very efficient because those resources being isolated by our partners, and these partners cover basically 90% of the all internet users in Russia. Okay, there's some graphs on second level and the third level of malware. Interesting that most of the phishing malware and the spam resources are in the second level. They're not necessary in the third level and other levels of domain names. So the majority of the database is about the second level domains. Also, there is some good trend because when we started, we actually started to collect the data so we can see the pattern of growth of the number of the malicious domain names. But since we were operates already more than a year, we can see a little positive trend that domain names being deleted from the registry database because of no use. And so let me go back to our partners. So, and again, repeat that. For example, Yandex is using this database for isolation of the search results. Kaspersky is 200 million installations of the antivirus software. Mail.ru has more than 100 million users in as an email platform. And Group IB is going after the criminals, and Rostelecom is doing some tricks on their network to isolate the bad resources. And also the site, which is listed, I listed in the first slide. Hold on. We call it the Netoscope. This site is actually the front end, which is available for the public, and anyone can check the domain name with .ru and .rf extension and get the history of this domain. It was if it was included in some bad data in the database of the bad resources. We plan to translate the site into English because we see a demand from abroad to check the domain names. And this is basically it. Just a short update of our old initiative. This is not the first time I'm talking about this initiative, but it's just update that this cooperation with the leading companies in Russia is really bringing the results. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, well, specific questions now on the Netoscope presentation from Andre. Aha, we got an eager.
It's on? Yeah. Hey, great, I love this. And this is also very similar to the same process. Norm Ritchie from the Secure Domain Foundation. This is very similar to what the Secure Domain Foundation is doing with all TLDs. It's not specific to any individuals. So two things. One, we notice domains in all TLDs. Happy to give those to you and add them to yours because we don't want to duplicate the effort, so we'll find a way of doing that. On that, do you have an API to submit domains in, or is it a manual process?
It's actually API. The number of our partners is limited. It's not like open for everybody because there is a tricky situation. It's a non-commercial project, and we don't want to compete with the guys who's actually involved into the security business. For example, the Group IB and Kaspersky. So we have to be really accurate in, you know, getting these connections done because we basically have all the resources from their commercial instances. So we do have APIs for the partners. We have a predefined data formats because we're getting all this data in a different format. So we have converters for the APIs. And also we plan to, it's actually will start very shortly, we'll upload the the whole database of the malicious domain names in .ru and ref to our registrars. And our registrars also have this API. They can add the suspicious domain names so it can be checked through the database.
Okay. So, yeah, so we have additional data that you may not have, so I'd like to figure out a way of giving that to you so it works for you, so we can talk offline.
Of course. I mean, we also work with some unlisted partners, and we're getting the feeds from the various sources, of course.
Okay.
Because it's increasing the quality of the database, of the resources.
Okay.
More partners we have, more quality it is.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Rolf.
Rolf Meijer from .nl. Andre, I didn't get your slide with the circular graph. Can you show it again?
Yeah. This one?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Does it mean that you have 750,000
malware? 1.2 million tagged domain names. It's a history.
Those are all.
That's for whole history, of course. It's since November 2012. It's a lot, I know.
Yeah? No, I thought that must be wrong. But okay, thank you. And I'm not being cynical, but I'm.
No, that's the way it is.
Do we have any more questions or comments? Yeah, please come to the microphone.
Hi, my name is John from .ipandi, bandi.id registry. I'm interested with your data because .ru is seems in Indonesia also so many phishing sites. Yeah, so is it possible that we have some cooperation so that we exchange the database with us?
We thought about it, but there is a natural divide, and you know this divide because when we're talking about the .ru and .rf domain names, we're talking about the Cyrillic sites. Those 95% of the sites used with these domain names are Cyrillic, targeted in the local populations. So the phishing tricks for the Russians are specifically in Russian. So we can do the cooperation with other countries, with other languages, but they'll be very, very short and minimal crossing between those bad resources because the bad guys, they operate on the local markets.
Okay. Thank you.
Stephen, you're on.
Stephen Derrick, .as. Andre, a quick question. If you have a domain in this list of miscreants and the registrations drop for whatever reason and sometime down the road it gets re-registered because it was once used, how do you guys, is there something special you do there or just as, what's your assumption?
We plan to launch a service called the Who Was. You can basically, if you are a registrant and you, of course, you're interested that when you, for example, if you buy the domain on the secondary market, you're interested that this domain should be like, you know, white and clean and, you know, whatever. And so it will be possible for the user to check the who was history and see if the domain was involved in some kind of malicious activity.
Thanks. Okay.
Neil.id. I just like to extend what my colleague has just said with the fact that some of the .ru is used to for malicious websites for phishing and so on, using other than the natural language that you have. So does your statistics include those languages or no?
No, we work only with our domain names. We don't accept. For example, we get the data feed from the search around the world, and we just cut off all resources which are not related .ru and .rf to our national domains. We don't process it.
Okay, so when we have problems, say for example with .ru, then report it to
you can send it to the traditional email address abuse@cctld.ru, and it works.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you, Andre. And hope you'll join me in thanking all of our presenters on this security topic. Byron.
Again, thank you to all the panelists. There was much interesting information there, and even a few laughs, so that always helps first thing in the morning. I'd also like to thank Nigel for chairing and being very good with his time management, so good, in fact, that we will have a few extra minutes for the coffee break, which we will commence now. And just a reminder that we will be back at 11 o'clock for the next session. Thanks.
Ze alle. Good morning.